Well, our speaker this evening, our second McDonald lecturer, is someone who will need no introduction to some of you, but others may not have met him or heard him before. But we are absolutely delighted that Professor John Lennox is with us this evening. John is the professor of mathematics at Oxford University, and he's a senior fellow of the Trinity Forum. He is also teaches in the Oxford Strategic Leadership Program at the Said Business School in Oxford and many other places as well. He travels all over the world speaking on topics like the one he's speaking on this evening. And he's written a number of books, including Gunning for God, 7 Days That Divide the World, God and Stephen Hawking, and God's Undertaker, Has Science Buried God? He's debated in public, and a number of the world's leading atheists, including Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, and Peter Singer as well. So it's a great privilege for us to have John with us this evening. So can we give a very warm welcome to Professor John Lennox?
Well, ladies and gentlemen, good evening to you. I must apologize for a rather irritating cough. I don't think I'm infectious. I spent quite a bit of my life in Russia. And in Russia, you sit to lecture. And I propose to do that this evening. It's actually a very good biblical precedent as well, sitting to teach, and I think it's much more friendly. So if you'll allow me, as an older person, to do that, I shall be extremely grateful. Now, I've been asked to think with you a little bit about the whole question of atheism, and in particular, the new atheism. The new atheism is old hat now. We've now got the new atheism. And the new atheism is very unlike the new atheism. It's like the old atheism. If that makes sense to you. The basic situation is, I think, that there's been a reaction against the militancy of what we've come to know as the new atheism. That extremely aggressive attitude which expresses its determination to obliterate religion. I think it was probably Steven Weinberg who put it most clearly when he, and he's a Nobel Prize winner for physics, he said the world needs to wake up from the long nightmare of religion. Anything we scientists can do to weaken the hold of religion should be done, and may in fact be our greatest contribution to civilization. Anything we scientists can do. And that, of course, sounds rather totalitarian. There's been a reaction against that aggressive attitude. I've noticed it personally in Oxford. Many of my friends are atheists and they distance themselves from this kind of militant, aggressive desire to eliminate any kind of religious expression. So the new atheists say, well, there are lots of good things in religion. Let's not knock it. Just let's not do God. And we'll all be happy. Well, of course, that's not a satisfactory situation either. But the influence of atheism is still massive within our society, particularly among young people. The book The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins is still causing all kinds of ripples, even though his own star may be on the wane. And I just want to address some of the main questions that come up in my mind. It's a huge topic, of course, and we could spend a lot of time on it. Basically, the argument is simple. Dawkins claims that 9/11 radicalized him. And that is religion, it's unacceptable, and therefore it must be eliminated. If you argue it's extremist religion, he'll say yes. But extremist religion thrives on the periphery of moderate religion, so you've got to get rid of all religion. They then, of course, realize that for centuries in the West, God has been the pole of ethics. And so they feel it incumbent upon them to have some kind of source for ethics that's independent of God. And that's a cottage industry at the moment, with a lot of activity being put into it. Where can we get a base of ethics that does without God? And they claim to be able to do so, I claim they can't. So the ethical questions come in. And what we've seen, I think, is this. We've seen a scientific attack. Science, the great guru, the great authority in the 21st century, is the source of eliminating religion. That's very clear. So now that they wish to put something in place of religion to give us a base for ethics, it has to be science that does that as well. There's no consideration of any other source. So we're dealing with a situation where science is given enormous authority. Now, I'm a scientist and I'm passionate about science, but the way in which things are going for some people veers towards what we call scientism. And that's a very dangerous idea. That's the idea that science is the only way to truth. Of course, that's logical nonsense, because the statement science is the only way to truth is not a statement of science. So if it's true, it's false. I hope you can see that at this time of the night. Logic perhaps isn't the right thing to be doing so late in the evening. But if scientism were true, as some suggest, then of course we'd have to close half the faculties in our universities straight away. There'd be no history, there'd be no languages, there'd be no art, there'd be no literature, and so on and so forth. Sir Peter Medawar, the great Oxford scientist, said, look, it's so easy to see that science has its limits. It cannot answer the simple questions of a child. Where do I come from? Where am I going to? What is the meaning of life? We have to look elsewhere for answers to those questions. And I think it's very important that we take that humble attitude. But nonetheless, there is a driving power to solve all of mankind's problems, including getting an ethical base by science. They don't listen to Einstein. Einstein once very perceptively put it this way. He said, you may speak about the ethical foundations of science, but you cannot speak of the scientific foundations of ethics. So let's approach it perhaps through the most famous book, The God Delusion. The claim that God is a delusion is a very strong claim. It is actually a psychiatric claim. Delusion is a psychiatric term. And Dawkins' definition of it will do for us tonight: a persistent false belief held in the face of strong contrary evidence. That's how he defines a delusion. And I'm going to be provocative tonight, ladies and gentlemen, and say that atheism satisfied that definition perfectly. A false belief held in the face of very strong contrary evidence. But I want to investigate this briefly with you, because the Freudian claim is usually the one people come across first. A strong assertion, God is a delusion, made by some famous scientist, and that ends the story. Well, the first obvious thing to say is that statements by scientists aren't always statements of science. The great danger, and it's a danger for me because I'm going outside my scientific field, way outside it tonight. And the danger is you use your authority in one field to make a pronouncement in another field. Now, to say God is a delusion with its psychiatric overtones, that invites investigation, because when I first read that, I thought, well, Richard Dawkins is not a psychiatrist, and nor am I. So why don't I consult a psychiatrist about this question to see if any work has been done on it in the field of psychiatry? And of course, a great deal of work has been done. I came across amongst other things, the writings of Andrew Sims, the past president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists here in the United Kingdom. And he's written a book called Is Faith a Delusion? And he comes to the exact opposite conclusion to Richard Dawkins. And the interesting thing is, he says that the advantageous effect of religious belief and spirituality is one of the best kept secrets in psychiatry and medicine generally. If the findings of the huge volume of research in this topic had gone in the opposite direction, and it had been found that religion damages your mental health, it would have been front page news in every newspaper in the land. Now that's a heavy statement. It's written by a psychiatrist, by a scientist working in that area. And here we come across my first and one of my major criticisms of the new atheists. They don't check the best scholarship in the fields they wander into. And because I'm not a psychiatrist, I did. Now, Andrew Sims in this book goes on very interestingly to enter a field that's becoming extremely popular in many universities. And that is the science of human flourishing. What does it mean for a human being to flourish? And I'm very interested, I've just been in the United States last week, to find in an increasing number of Ivy League universities, there are now courses on human flourishing which have attracted great interest among the students. And what Andrew Sims does is to cite major epidemiological analyses of this whole thing. A lot of work has been done on it, unknown to Dawkins. And he points out, for instance, religious involvement in the majority of studies is correlated with well-being, happiness, life satisfaction, hope, optimism, purpose, meaning in life, higher self-esteem, better adaptation to bereavement, greater social support, less loneliness, lower rates of depression, faster rates of recovery from depression, and so on. That's not bad, is it? And yet we hear nothing of that positive side in the writings of Richard Dawkins. The second point I'd like to make is the work of Manfred Lutz. Manfred Lutz is one of Germany's leading and most famous psychiatrists. And he's written a book called A Brief History of the Great One, meaning God. And he's quite a wit, actually. And the book is very enjoyable reading. But he makes a very important point. As I say, many people are stumbled at the first hurdle when they hear Freud's ancient argument that belief in God is clearly a delusion, it's a wish fulfillment, it's a desire for some father figure in the sky, and so on, and that settles the whole problem. Lutz says it does settle the whole problem if there is no God. He said Freud's argument is brilliant. If there is no God, to show you that faith in God is delusory. But if there is a God, the very same argument shows you atheism is a delusion. It's a projection of the desire never to have to meet God and give account for the things we've done wrong and so on, if there is a God. So his bottom line is very clear. He says on the question whether there's a God or not, Freud can't help you and neither can Jung or Frankl. You'll have to look elsewhere. And as an illustration of that, if you'll forgive the personal reference, Stephen Hawking was asked by the Times, I think, what he thought of religion. And he said it's a fairy story for people afraid of the dark. And I was asked to comment, so I said atheism is a fairy story for people afraid of the light. Well, it's nice of you to laugh, but if you've understood my argument up to now, that proves nothing. These are just assertions. We have to go deeper than that. But I mention this because it often puts people off at the very first hurdle. That's it settled. Freud sorted it out long ago, and so there's no God. That simply isn't true. And it has been important to me in my life, always when I meet a new argument, to see if it applies in the opposite direction. And very frequently it does, and neutralizes any apparent effect of its argument when used against God. Now, following the idea that atheists are under certain delusions, I want to come to the next one. And that is their delusional definition of faith. As a Christian, I will speak of faith in God. By that I mean that I trust God on the basis of evidence, both objective in terms of the documents of the New Testament, the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, and on the basis of my own subjective experience. In other words, my faith is evidence-based, as of course any sensible faith is. I've been married for 46 years. I trust my wife. I've got reason for doing so. I've got 46 years of evidence that she's trustworthy. And many of you in this audience can reflect this kind of thing. We know why we trust certain people and why we don't trust other people. We know why we accept certain propositions and why we reject others. That seems very plain sailing. The word faith in English comes from the Latin fides, from which we get fidelity, trust, and so on. So we know what that means, but the new atheists appear not to know what that means. Because you get them saying, well, for instance, here's Dawkins, atheists do not have faith. And then he writes a book on what he believes. Faith is one of the evils of the world comparable to the smallpox virus, but harder to eradicate. And what I unearth here is that what has happened in our culture, and it's extremely important, I meet it everywhere. I meet it among many of my colleagues who are very bright people. They think that faith is a religious term and it means believing where there's no evidence. Now let me repeat that, because I found it almost impossible to grasp this until I kept getting it. Faith is a religious word only. And it means believing where there's no evidence. Now, you can partly see how that's happened, because we use the word faith as a shorthand for various religions. We talk about the Christian faith, the Jewish faith, and so on. We need to be very careful, because what has happened is that now many atheists will come to me and say, well, of course, you're a man of faith. That's an insult in their view. Because it means that Lennox believes, well, there's no evidence, there's no point in discussing with him. Now, this has got so deep in that they won't discuss any evidence because they don't think we've got any. And therefore, I think we need to expose this as a delusion. It is a persistent falsehood, actually, held against strong countervailing evidence. I was amazed to discover A.C. Grayling, who's a philosopher based in London here, the New College of the Humanities, arguing that Jesus expects people to believe without any evidence. And I thought, what is this? So I was intrigued immediately to look up what he was quoting. And he was quoting the story of Doubting Thomas. You'll remember that when Jesus rose from the dead, he appeared to his disciples, and Thomas wasn't there. And they told him what they'd seen. He didn't believe them. And he said, unless I see it myself, I'm not going to believe it. And then Jesus appeared. And Thomas fell at his feet and said, my Lord and my God. And Jesus said to him, Thomas, because you've seen, you've believed. Happy rather those who have not seen and yet believe. There you are, says Grayling. Jesus says he wants you to believe without evidence. My response to that is, can the man not read? Jesus didn't say, because you've had no evidence, you've believed. He said, because you haven't seen. Seeing is only one faculty. None of us in this room who are Christians have seen Jesus like the disciples did. Does that mean we've no evidence? Of course not. We've masses of evidence. The only bit we don't have is that bit that concerns our vision. You see? The irony, of course, of the whole thing is if Grayling had read the very next statement, he would have seen his mistake. Because the very next statement in John's Gospel is, many other signs Jesus did in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written in order that you might believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name. In other words, I've compiled a book full of signs that are the evidence upon which faith can be based. It's evidence-based faith, but he didn't read that bit. He simply misunderstood the story of doubting Thomas. That's not serious philosophy to my mind. And until some of these people, forgive me for saying it, grow up and learn to take the evidence of the Christian faith as serious philosophy, they're never going to discover their mistakes. So there's a delusional definition of faith. Now, the problem is it has very serious consequences. Because relegating faith to the religious sphere and then saying it's believing without evidence covers up an utterly fundamental fact about science. And that is, science is faith dependent from its very inception. Einstein once said he couldn't imagine a scientist without that faith. Now, he didn't mean faith in God. He meant faith that science could be done. Or to put it more technically, he meant faith in the rational intelligibility of the universe. I wouldn't do science if I didn't believe it could be done. But what's involved? What do you have to believe in order to do science? You have to believe that the universe is approachable by human reason. You can ask it questions and you get answers. Now, why would you believe that? Now, this is a very interesting thing, because the early pioneers of science, Kepler, Galileo, Newton, and so on, would tell you instantly why they believed science could be done. Why was it? Because they believed in a creator. C.S. Lewis, as usual, puts it beautifully when he says, men became scientific. Why? Because they expected law and nature. Why? Because they believed in a lawgiver. That was the motor that drove science. It's ironic that so many scientists now don't believe in God when the early pioneers that gave us modern science did believe in God. And I'm not remotely embarrassed to be both a scientist and a Christian for the reason that, if I might put it this way, Christianity gave me my subject. So there's no reason for me to be embarrassed by it. But now, let's take the atheist perspective. And I often have fun with this, you know, when I meet colleagues. I ask them, what do you do science with? They say, well, I got this million-pound machine in my lab. I said, I don't mean that. I mean this. Oh, they say, you mean my, and they almost say mind, and they remember not to say mind because there's no such thing as mind, according to them. They say, my brain. Well, I say, okay, I do believe there's a distinction between the mind and the brain, a very big one, but many of them don't. Okay, you do science with your brain. Tell me about the brain. Well, do you want the long story or the short story? The short story, please. Okay, here's the shortest possible story of the brain. The brain is the end result of an unguided process that didn't have it in mind. And I just say to them, and you trust it? And you trust it? Why on earth would you trust the product of an unguided, mindless process? Now, this is a serious objection. You might, some of you, be surprised to learn it was first raised by Charles Darwin. It's called Darwin's Doubt. And he said, look, essentially, in my belief, the mind of humans arose from the mind of lower animals, but would you trust a monkey's mind if there's anything in such a mind? Now, that has shifted now to move into center stage in this whole debate. C.S. Lewis saw it in the 1940s. He said, no line of reasoning can be valid that invalidates reason. Let me repeat that. No reasoning can be valid that invalidates reason. And what happens is that the current naturalistic explanation for the human mind invalidates reason. Now, it's not only Christians who are saying this. That's the fascinating thing. One of the world's leading philosophers is a man called Thomas Nagel. And he's written a book with an explosive subtitle. I've never read a subtitle like it. The title is very innocent, Mind and Cosmos. The subtitle is not. Why the Neo-Darwinian View of the World is Almost Certainly False. Now, this is an atheist writing. And if you want to see the waves he's caused, just look him up in cyberspace. And he's essentially taking this argument that if we are reducing our thoughts essentially to mindless, unguided processes or movements of atoms and elementary particles, we are snatching the rug from under the feet of any validation that our cognitive processes could be valid. So we've no reason to trust them. And that cannot be so. So here we have the fascinating situation that Christianity gives a base for trusting reason and was the inspiration for the rise of modern science, whereas atheism is undermining that in a very big way, and some atheists are beginning to see it. So watch this space. I think there's going to be an increasingly fascinating debate about it. So we might sum the position up. I think this is one of the best statements of it by the American Christian philosopher, who's a world-class philosopher, Alvin Plantinga. If Dawkins is right that we are the product of mindless, unguided natural processes, then he has given a strong reason to doubt the reliability of human cognitive faculties, and therefore inevitably to doubt the validity of any belief that they produce, including Dawkins' own science and his atheism. His biology and his belief in naturalism would therefore appear to be at war with each other in a conflict that has nothing at all to do with God. Or putting it another way, I'm often asked to speak to the title, "Is Science Buried God?" My answer is no, but science is beginning to do a good job of burying atheism. Because what I'm saying is, you can't have science and atheism logically coexisting. If you're going to validity to science, you have to validate human cognitive processes. So you mustn't adhere to a naturalistic philosophy that undermines them and destroys them. This seems to me to be one of the central things. So let me sum it up in a very simple way. One of my main reasons as a scientist for not being an atheist is that I can do science. It's nothing to do with my Christianity in that sense, although it has indirectly. It's to do with my science. So that's one of the possible approaches here. Now, I want to say one or two things that are important because so many younger people today feel, especially with Stephen Hawking's utterances, that you've got to choose between science and God. That's ironic because Hawking occupied Isaac Newton's chair. Isaac Newton didn't think you have to choose between science and God. In fact, when he discovered his law of gravity and wrote his famous book, Principia Mathematica, he expressed the hope that it would persuade a thinking person to believe in God. And now here's Stephen Hawking, who says the exact opposite. And I think we can understand the debate if we understand the difference between these two men and their attitudes. Number one, and it took me a very long time to twig this, part of the confusion is not about the nature of science, it's about the nature of God. Why does Hawking say you've got to choose between God and science? I suspect because that's the way he's defined God. Now let me try and explain that to you. You see, in my youth, which is centuries ago now, When I talked about God, I would expect an audience to understand that I was talking about the triune God of Christian theology, the creator and sustainer of the universe, the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, and so on. But now no longer. And what I suddenly wakened up to discover is many of my colleagues think that the God that I believe in is like a Greek God of lightning, say. And you know about the Greek God of lightning. She or he disappears in lecture one of atmospheric physics at Imperial College London, because that kind of a God is what we call a God of the gaps. I can't explain it, therefore God did it. Now follow my logic. It's very simple, but I believe it's very important. If you define God to be such a God of the gaps, then you have to choose between God and science, because that's the way you've defined God. Shall I say that again? If you define God to be God of the gaps, you force a choice between God and science, because that's the way you've defined God. But I don't know any sensible Christian, indeed monotheist, who believes in a God like that. Genesis doesn't say, in the beginning, God created the bits of the universe we don't understand. I hope you've noticed that. In the beginning, God created what? The heavens and the earth, the whole show. The bits we do understand and the bits we don't, which is why Isaac Newton parts company from Stephen Hawking. Because when Isaac Newton discovered the law of gravity, he didn't say, oh, I've got a law of gravity, I don't need God. No, he said, what a marvelous God that did it that way. Now, Stephen Hawking says, because we have a law of gravity, we don't need God. The same law of gravity plays the exact opposite role in the thinking of those two men. It's fascinating. The central argument of Hawking's book, The Grand Design, is precisely that. Because there is a law of gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. And when I read that at first, I thought, what? Because there is a law of gravity, because there is something, the universe will create itself from nothing. Well, that's a flat contradiction. And it gets worse and worse as you investigate the sentence. The universe will create itself? If I say to you, X creates Y, that roughly means if you've got X, you'll get Y. If I say X creates X, what does that mean? Well, if you've got X, you'll get X. And what does that mean? Well, it means that nonsense is still nonsense, even if scientists write it. You see, his central argument collapses totally. And that's why I wrote my little book, God and Stephen Hawking. I was just so amazed at the lack of philosophical insight. I'm still waiting for a reply to it, by the way. So this idea, God or science, needs to be scotched. But it needs to be scotched from the scientific side. And that's easy to do. It really is easy to do. If we realize just the simple fact that there are different kinds of explanation. Why is the kettle boiling? Well, because the heat from the Bunsen burner is conducted through the copper base of the kettle, and it's agitating the molecules of water, and they're getting angry, and they're going faster and faster and faster, and that's why it's boiling. No, it's not. It's boiling because I'd like a cup of tea. Now, you laugh because you see that's a ridiculous statement. Both of those explanations are valid, but they're not the same explanation. The one is in terms of science, the other is in terms of my intentionality. Now, why people cannot see that about the universe, I just don't know. Newton saw it. You see, the existence of laws and mechanisms that do things is not normally evidence for the absence of a creator that designed them. It's normally evidence for his existence. And I often say to people, pitching God against science is like pitching Henry Ford against the law of internal combustion as an explanation for a motor car. It's that absurd. Because God is not, peace be to Richard Dawkins, the same kind of explanation as a scientific explanation. So he doesn't disappear as science grows. In fact, the evidence of his genius increases as science grows. As we all know, the more you know of engineering, the more you admire a Rolls-Royce and his genius in producing its engine. Now, these are very simple things, but I believe that those two things, firstly, confusion about the nature of God, and secondly, confusion about the nature of explanation, go a long way in explaining the fact that so many of our leading scientists offer young people a choice between science and God. It's as simple as that. They are false alternatives, and they need to be treated as such. Now, I want to change the tune completely just for a moment or two, because a lot of venom is being directed against God at the moral level. Stephen Fry, in his outburst in Ireland recently, is just one in a long list of this kind of thing. Now, I come from Ireland. You may have recognized that on the way along. And I get this a great deal. Okay, talk about the science all you like and the evidence of design and so on, but look at the mess the world's in. And religion, worse still, your religion is responsible for most of it. And that's where so much of this venom is coming from. And we need to address that. I'm going to try to do that very briefly. Firstly, as someone who's known the effects of religious violence and whose family has been bombed and damaged by it, I feel I've got a minimal right to say something. You might be surprised by what I will say, though. I'm utterly ashamed of it. Utterly ashamed that the name of Christ has ever been associated with an AK-47 or a bomb. Now let me explain why. The reason is that people that take bombs and AK-47s to defend Christ or his message are not following him, they're disobeying him. Now, I used to wonder, ladies and gentlemen, why there is so much in the New Testament about the trial of Jesus. I had a debate with the late Christopher Hitchens at the Edinburgh Festival, and I'll never forget it, because he stood up and for 15 minutes there was just invective against religion, and it was essentially right. And so I got up and I said, Christopher, that's exactly right. That is the unacceptable face of religion. But I'd like to point out to you that Christ stands at your side in condemning it. I had a private conversation with him afterwards about it. I said, I don't understand you, Christopher, because your reaction against exploitative religion, against violent religion, is exactly the same as that of Jesus Christ. He was amazed. I said, don't you read the Gospels? Do you not realize why Jesus was put on trial? He was put on trial for being a political terrorist. Let's put it into modern language. That's exactly what he was accused of. And that's why Pilate, the Roman governor, was so nervous that he took the case himself. I mean, that's such an exceptional thing. A carpenter, a wandering carpenter from Galilee, that the Roman governor wouldn't take such a person under his notice. But he was so nervous about anybody claiming to be a political threat to Rome, so he put Christ on trial so the whole world would know that he was innocent of the charge of political violence. Isn't it ironic that the very charge these people are making against Christianity is the charge that was made against Jesus? And Jesus was acquitted. Why? Well, there are multiple reasons. Very briefly, you will know when they came to arrest him, Peter and one of the other disciples had managed to get a couple of swords, and they weren't very good at using them. And Peter took a terrific swipe trying to cut the head off the high priest's servant, and managed to take his ear off. Do you remember that story? And Dr. Luke, a physician, tells us that Jesus put the ear back on. Now, I believe that. That's another big issue, miracles and so on, that we could talk about. And I can't help saying that it preaches a very powerful message. If you take up weapons to defend Christ or his message, you'll cut the ears off people in a very big way. Many of my friends won't listen to my presentation of the Christian faith because their ears have been cut off. They've had a very negative experience of Christianity. They've been a subject of religious violence or something like this. Their ears have been chopped off. So let me appeal to you, if you're a Christian, you need to get into the ear repair business and start putting the ears on people. That's what Christ did. Secondly, Pilate interviewed Jesus. Are you a king? Well, yes, but not in the way you mean. My kingdom is not of this world. And Jesus explained it. Otherwise, my servants would have been fighting. Not that kind of a political revolutionary king. No, what sort of a king? Well, to this end I was born, and to this end I came into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. I'd love to have been there, wouldn't you, when Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" and went out and said he's innocent. But what was the mechanism of it? Well, surely the obvious. Pilate could see, like you can see, that the one thing that you cannot do with violence is impose truth. Especially if it's the truth about the love of God, forgiveness, salvation, peace with God, and eternal life. You cannot impose that by violence. Pilate saw it and acquitted him for all time. Of course, he then caved into the crowd, as you know, and had Jesus crucified. But this is very important, ladies and gentlemen. Historical evidence shows that Christ was tried for the charge that's made again and again against him and his followers, and he was declared innocent of it. Now, there's more to be said, because the interesting thing is about the new atheism, which is why it doesn't impress me, is it blames everything on religion. It doesn't say anything good about Christianity. Now, I'm speaking as a Christian tonight. Other religions must speak for themselves on this. But you know, so many of our institutions in this country, hospices, hospitals, our legal institutions, our universities, are Christian foundations. The legacy of Christianity positively is massive. And in fact, I normally quote an atheist on this because sometimes the atheists put it even better than we do. Jürgen Habermas is one of the most distinguished atheists in the world, a German. And he says that universalistic egalitarianism, from which sprang the ideals of freedom and a collective life in solidarity, the autonomous conduct of life and emancipation, the individual morality of conscience, human rights, and democracy, is the direct legacy of the Judaic ethic of justice and the Christian ethic of love. This is an atheist writing. To this day, there's no alternative to it. Everything else is just idle postmodern chatter. That's a very strong statement. He's recognizing the legacy. Behind the European Declaration of Human Rights, there lies Christianity. It's easy to forget William Wilberforce and all the vast benefit that's flowed to us through people who have achieved great social reform because they took their Christianity seriously. So blame it all on God. Say nothing positive about Christianity, but now say nothing negative about atheism. John Lennon's song, Imagine. Imagine a world without religion. You've all heard it, haven't you? Well, I'm not John Lennon, I'm John Lennox. And I've written a song called Imagine. It's an imagine a world without Hitler, Stalin, or Pol Pot. What about that world? Why don't they tell us about that world? One of the things that concerns me most, ladies and gentlemen, is not only the new atheist rewriting of first century history, it's their revisionist rewriting of 20th century history. I mean, I just found it staggering in The God Delusion Dawkins says he does not believe there's an atheist in the world who would bulldoze Mecca or Chartres, York, Minster or Notre Dame. He hasn't been much to Russia, I have, and stared into many holes in the ground where there once were churches. And Richard Schroeder, professor of philosophy in Berlin from East Germany, wrote, he said, well, cathedrals are actually too high for bulldozers. In the Soviet Union under Stalin and the German Democratic Republic under Ulbricht, they used explosives instead. For instance, to blow up the university church at Leipzig in 1968. Stalin, after all, only closed 54,000 churches. Atheism has done nothing. Oh, but wasn't Stalin a seminary student? People that say things like that, ladies and gentlemen, haven't a clue about the heart of Marxism. I spent a lot of time talking to Russian people about these things. And I suppose, to cut a long story short, the one of the best people to quote is Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Because he said in 1989, if I were asked today to formulate as concisely as possible the main cause of the ruinous revolution that swallowed up some 60 million of our people, I could not put it more accurately than to say men have forgotten God. That's why all this has happened. Ivan, many a Russian agree with that. And that is a bridge now to another huge subject that would take a whole evening. And it's this. This moral outrage against God is a moral outrage. But on what moral base does it stand? Because if you get rid of God, where do you get a moral base from? And into the field swims the famous statement of Dostoevsky in the Brothers Karamazov: if God does not exist, everything is permissible. He didn't mean atheists couldn't behave. Of course they can. Whether they believe in God or not, from where I sit, they're made in the image of God, they're moral beings. What Dostoevsky meant was, there is no right and wrong if you follow the atheist track. Now, this is important to realize, that people like Richard Dawkins teach that. I'm going to cut a very long story short here. I've written about it in my book, Gunning for God. So let me just come down to this statement of his belief about morality. In a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky. And you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe is precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. So as Jihadi John cuts the head off someone, he's just dancing to the music of his DNA. Is that right? Well, that's the end of all morality. And it's important that we realize that here, in this statement of Dawkins, that he's never withdrawn, so far as I know, you see echoes of hard atheism. Nietzsche, particularly, who said if you get rid of God, in the end you will get rid of any moral values at all. You cannot adhere to Western, liberal, democratic, basically Christian values, once you get rid of God, you will destroy humans in the end too. So what we need to do, I think, is to be very honest with our fellow human beings and point out where this is all going. It's going to a world without good, without evil. But then why do they rail about the problem of evil and how horrible God is? If there's no good, there's no evil. I'll tell you why they do it. Because their philosophy is inconsistent with their being. What do I mean by that? I mean that they, like All of us are human beings made in the image of God, and therefore they're moral beings. So they still will make a moral objection. And that's why we have to be able to answer it. But it seems to me to be utterly tragic to be writing stuff like that. Because if you communicate that to young people for a few generations, they'll start to believe it, won't they? And many of them do. There is no absolute morality. There's no morality at all. And the most tragic thing of all, and I put it to Dawkins, there's no justice. Now, this opens a huge problem. But I pointed out to him, I said, Richard, you know, if you're right, the vast majority of people who've ever lived will never get justice. Oh, well, I work for justice in this world. But I said, that's wonderful. But it still is a fact. We all do that. It still is the fact that the vast majority of people in the world will never see justice, which means in the end that their conscience that cries for justice is a delusion. And are you going to tell me that the consciences of the people, I was watching it the other day, very moving, perhaps you watched it too, the 70th anniversary of Auschwitz, and that impassioned plea by that 92-year-old survivor, we must do everything we can, that our past is not our children's future. But in a world where there is no good, no evil, and we're dancing to the music of our DNA, that is a hideous world. So, ladies and gentlemen, I submit to you tonight that atheism is a delusion. But fortunately, there is something that isn't a delusion. Thank you very much indeed.